The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Boot computer, list of today's guests, signing in chat room, lining up news articles, checking level, adjusting camera, secure wire connection, restart computer, checking video feed.
With all she's got to do, you'd think Nicole Sandler was a one-woman band. Well, she is, and she's ready for another show. And now, here's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
The good news is that it's Friday. Hey, that means Marcy Wheeler's here. So we're going to get to it in just a second. As you may know, you should know, Marcy is in Ireland. I am in Arizona. So we record these Friday get-togethers in the morning Arizona time. That's only a problem on days when, you know, a verdict is handed down or a decision after Marcy and I finish recording, which is what happened today. So Judge Engoron in New York finally ruled on a Letitia James lawsuit against Trump. You may recall she brought the suit to force the Trump Organization to give up around $370 million in profits for falsifying the values of their assets. She wanted to bar Trump and his adult male spawn from doing business in New York and revoke the company's certificate to do business in the state going forward. Well, the judge gave her almost everything she wanted. So you know that the judge already found Trump's guilty. And so this was really just the penalty phase, if you will. So the ruling handed down today ordered the former guy to pay nearly $355 million. Oops, wrong one. I went to the wrong place. It was just supposed to be a ding. $355 million and Don Jr. and Eric to each pay $4 million. And Alan Weisselberg, the former Trump Organization CFO, pay $1 million. Now, I think the reason this verdict was delayed was because of the revelations that Alan Weisselberg committed perjury. But all parties asked the judge just to move on, leave it alone, and just continue with his ruling. So I guess that's what this is about. The order also barred Trump from serving as a corporate officer or director of a company in New York for 3 years and barred his sons from the same for 2 years. So the Trumps did avoid the so-called corporate death penalty, as Engoron did not revoke the Trump Organization certificate to do business in New York moving forward. Seriously, who is going to do business with them? All right, there's one other part I need to read to you. So the ruling was 92 pages. No, I didn't read the whole thing. I have my shortcuts. But on page 87 is where Judge Engoron got explicitly critical. And here's what he wrote. The English poet Alexander Pope first declared, "To err is human, to forgive is divine." Defendants, he writes, apparently are of a different mind. After some 4 years of investigation and litigation, the only error, inadvertent, of course, that they acknowledge is the tripling of the size of the Trump Tower penthouse, which cannot be gainsaid, G-A-I-N-S-A-I-D, a word I don't know. Their complete lack of contrition and remorse borders on pathological. Yeah. They are accused only of inflating asset values to make more money. The documents prove this over and over again. This is a venial sin, not a mortal sin. Defendants did not commit murder or arson. They did not rob a bank at gunpoint. Donald Trump is not Bernard Madoff. Yeah, but he tried to overturn an election, but I digress. Back to the judge. Yet, defendants are incapable of admitting the error of their ways. Instead, they adopt a, quote, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil posture that the evidence belies. This court is not constituted to judge morality. It is constituted to find facts and apply the law. In this particular case, in applying the law to the facts. The court intends to protect the integrity of the financial marketplace and thus the public as a whole. Defendants' refusal to admit error, indeed to continue it according to the Independent Monitor, constrains this court to conclude that they will engage in it going forward unless judicially restrained. Indeed, Donald Trump testified that even today, he does not believe the Trump Organization needed to make any changes based on the facts that came out during this trial. $355 million. Okay, works for me. Anyway, so now it's time to get on with Marcy. So we taped this morning. Thus, you'll hear us say we're still waiting for Judge Engoron's decision. That, of course, came down. What we're waiting for now is the Supreme Court ruling on Trump's absolute immunity. I don't know that we'll get it today, but if it does come down during this hour when the segment with Marcy is running, I'll come on at the end and tell you what happened. If anything breaks in the next hour, I will share it with you. With that, take it away. The magic of videotape. Wow, I take off a few days and all hell breaks loose. Marcy Wheeler is here. It is Friday, and thank goodness, because there is so much going on. I don't even know where to begin. I guess as we're recording this, it is Friday morning, 10 a.m. in Arizona. It's late afternoon in Ireland where Marcy is. But one thing that's happening as we speak is Fani Willis's father is on the stand in this hearing in Georgia as I guess the Trump faction seeks to disqualify her from this prosecution in the Georgia election stealing case. Why is her father on the stand?
Her father's on the stand for two reasons. One is because he is the only one who lived with Fani during a period when she was apparently falsely accused to be dating Nate Wade. Mm-hmm. And so he testified that he never met Nate Wade. He did meet some other guy named Deuce, who's a DJ who Fani Willis was dating, which was new testimony from him. And then the other reason is that Willis claims that when she went on a couple of trips with Nate Wade, she paid him back in cash. And she had said on the stand, when my daddy comes, he'll explain to you that he raised me to always carry cash. And he just told the same story as well. And he said, yes, he did. Like, I don't want to be racist, but this is a black thing. Like, you know, I can't tell you the number of times I've gone and tried to pay with a credit card. And
or a traveler's check.
Card.
He just said traveler's checks and they wouldn't even take those. But he had a $10 bill. And that led to him telling her to always have like 6 months cash on hand. Right.
Right. And right. And so this is the part of the story. In fact, when it came out yesterday, one of the defendants, David Schaefer, kind of guffawed out loud in the middle of the hearing. Mm-hmm. And the judge, who is quite even tempered, was sort of like, that happens again, you're leaving the courtroom.
Wow. Yeah, I watched some of it yesterday. Fani Willis, you know, it looked like it was kind of shaky before she took the stand. And she was just, all right, bring it. What do you want to ask me? This is ridiculous. You're on trial for trying to steal an election. I'm not on trial. You know, so let's not get things confused here. I thought she was great.
I have to be honest. I think Nate Wade was better.
Do you?
For the purposes. Because Willis...
she was evasive at times.
She lost her cool.
Yes, she did.
You know, there were a couple times where the judge had to kind of say, you've got to calm down. And I get it. Like, she, you know, they have accused her of sleeping with Nate Wade the very first time she met him in 2019, when all they did was like exchange business cards coming out of a training session. So the allegations they're making against her are ridiculous. And you know, it's clear that you've got a contentious divorce. You've got a fired employee who are behind these claims, and some of the claims that Mike Roman's lawyer said those witnesses would attest to, they did not attest to. So the question is, you know, I think there are bigger holes in Nate Wade's story than in Fani Willis's. For example, in his divorce proceedings, he answered a question about whether he had an affair with anybody. And he says he answered it through the period when he was still living as a married person with a spouse through 2015. But the question was asked in 2023, and so he didn't acknowledge Fani Willis. So that's one, that's the biggest hole in the story so far, and the fact that she paid cash on these trips. I think it's pretty compelling. You know, and I, that one of the other things we've learned from this hearing is that, again, Mike Roman claimed that they were dating from 2019 or sleeping together from, I mean, like at various points in this hearing, Fani has been questioned by these white crackers, right? That, you know, when did you, basically they've stopped short of saying, when did you fuck Nate Wade? But they not far
and
short.
And when did you stop fucking Nate Wade? And when did the relationship end? And it was just, you know, like, come on already. So, you know,
But one important detail is that, at least according to Wade and Willis, their relationship, to the extent it happened, was a much shorter period than these people are claiming. So 2022 until 2023, when Willis was asked yesterday when that was, she said the physical relationship ended in spring, and that's when Nate Wade would say, and I say later in summer. And, you know, so one of the issues is that one of the claims that people are making that she had an incentive to charge this as a RICO conspiracy instead of, say, false statements doesn't make sense anymore because they were already split up by the time the prosecutorial decisions were made. You know, we'll see what happens. I think that they're not going to be able to disqualify certainly Willis. Now they're trying to say that Willis knew she should have disclosed her relationship with Wade. She said, well, I'm treating him as a contractor. You know, one of my favorite parts of the hearings, I haven't watched all of it, but one of my favorite parts is they called Rory Barnes to the stand, who is the former governor of Georgia. And he is, I mean, there's a lot of fine Southern culture here. And it's clear that Willis, her dad is not from Georgia. Her dad is from, you know, he's an attorney himself, has spent a lot of time in D.C., spent a lot of time in South Africa, ties to Nelson Mandela, and just a beautiful story. Like, what a fascinating dad, right?
Yes.
So me and some of the other people.
And during COVID, he was in her house saying he had to protect it. She couldn't live there anymore. And he was writing his memoirs. I want to read his memoirs. I'm looking forward to that.
I mean, her dad is great. But the point is, they're not from Georgia.
Right.
And so one of the things that's going on is and she said, like, when she came up, and it wasn't clear she was going to testify, she came up, waltzed onto the stand, sat down. She said, you know, Nate Wade, as you know, is a fine Southern gentleman. Well, I am not. And there's a cultural disconnect, even between the people of color. Like, Nate Wade always, every single time he answered a question, was like, sir, madam, you know, very deferential. But that's true too. Like, Roy Barnes gets on the stand and everyone's like, ah, Roy Barnes. And they're all talking about, you know, the cases they've tried together. It was this kind of old Southern culture, and Fani Willis is not of that culture. Right. And that is one of the things that is going on. I mean, I think that it's clear that Mike Roman's attorney wildly overstated her claims. I think there is some question about disclosure and Nate Wade's testimony. I think that, you know, there's going to be this big thing about, is it true whether black people actually stash a bunch of cash in their house? I don't, you know, that's what it's going to come down to. So
well it's, you know, it may not be all black people, but her family, I think it's pretty well established. Now, just one last question on this. Explain who Mike Romans is and why he was able to bring this to court. Why it's a thing.
Mike Roman is, so he's one of the charged, the 19 charged co-defendants, or of the ones that remain. So
fake
whatever,
electors?
16 or 15. No, he, so understand, before he worked for Trump, he was the Koch's basically spy, and largely a spy. I mean, he did some spying on Democrats, but largely a spy against Republicans. Mm-hmm. His job is kind of the enforcer for Republican adherents. You know, there was a profile, I think, in the Washington Post where they described him demonstrating to his spouse how he could tap the open Wi-Fi in a hotel to figure out what other hotel guests were doing.
We talked about that.
How he used a drone to spy on Democratic events. So he's a spy. He is a spy. And he's also the guy who was, there are two people who were instrumental in the fake electors plot. One was Boris Epstein, who's not charged in Georgia. And the other one is Mike Roman, who is. Mike Roman was the one sort of in charge of the nitty gritty of making sure that certificates got moved around and stuff like that. So that's who he is. But so you've got the spy and his attorney, who is well who is well regarded, I guess, and very aggressive. I think she, there are moments in these hearings where you can see that she realized she overstepped and she's going to be in some ethical troubles herself. But those are the dynamics. Mike Roman is a spy, and he found details about Fannie Willis, some of which have come to fruition, some of which have not. They're as we're taping this, Nate Wade's partner is due to take the stand, and he's the last one who might corroborate the basic claims about when Fannie and Nate Wade first started dating.
How long do we think this is going to go on? It's got to be wrapped. Fannie Willis's attorneys did not call her today to rebut or to cross-examine her, saying that they believe her testimony yesterday gave them all they need, that she cannot be disqualified. So they did not call her today.
The judge is trying to finish it today.
Let's hope. Okay.
There are going to be, I think the DAs are going to call some witnesses against the former Willis friend who claimed that Wade and Willis were dating earlier.
Right. Her former friend. She said she's not my friend anymore. All right. So that's the Fannie Willis thing that's going on. Should end today. We won't have an answer today, but it's looking like, well, I don't know what it's looking like. You can never tell. But if you had to make a guess, you'd say she will not be disqualified.
Correct.
Okay. Also breaking overnight, a lot of news broke overnight. Alexei Navalny is dead in a Russian prison camp. Not really.
The Russians say he's dead.
Right. So that's, you know, that sort of hijacked the news this morning. We also learned that the Hunter Biden case is sort of, the shit is hitting the fan there. Can you explain what happened? A new indictment of what, one of their key witnesses that blows the whole thing up?
So I have written and we have talked a lot about how days after DOJ shut down a corruption investigation into the head of Burisma, Zlochevsky, mm-hmm. in 2019, during impeachment, Bill Barr set up a way, starting on January 3rd, 2020, during impeachment, mm-hmm. for Rudy Giuliani to share the dirt that he got while he was traipsing around Ukraine and Russia, including from Andrei Derkach. Everyone knew at that point, everyone treated him as a Russian spy. So Bill Barr set that up. He had the very Trumpy U.S. attorney for Pittsburgh in charge of it. And the very Trumpy U.S. attorney from Pittsburgh was really pushing hard to make this case. We learned there's an indictment from yesterday, and we learned in the indictment that this was started as a bribery assessment. So, again, Bill Barr shuts down an investigation into Zlochevsky, opens this bribery assessment into the Bidens, days apart. As part of this, and in the testimony from Scott Brady that I'm the only kind of credible person to have read, like I keep screaming at journalists, go find a transcript, because it is the most shocking thing to come out of the impeachment inquiry, I think, before this indictment yesterday. In Scott Brady, the same U.S. attorney, in his testimony, he describes that he found a reference to Hunter Biden in an informant report by searching on Hunter Biden and Burisma. So exactly the same, exactly the thing that that Trump asked Zelensky to go find.
Right.
Bill Barr said to Scott Brady, go find stuff about Hunter Biden and Zlochevsky from this investigation we just shut down weeks ago. Right.
They had made offered the plea deal, right? That's the plea deal, and it was done. And
don't know how that got shut down. Okay. The only reason we believe it was shut down is because Chuck Grassley kind of blabbed his mouth one day. And so I'm basing that on what Chuck Grassley said publicly.
Okay.
And again, this is an investigation of Zlochevsky that, according to Chuck Grassley, was open in 2016 when Joe Biden was VP and Hunter Biden was on the board of Burisma, and shut down in 2019 in the middle of impeachment when Donald Trump's impeachment defense was to say, we believe corruption at Burisma is serious. Then they opened this corruption investigation into the Bidens, the same thing they've just shut down into Burisma. And eventually they go interview this this informant whose name we now know is Alexander
Smirnov.
Yeah, I'm like, we'd name the vodka, right?
Smirnov.
Going through the better vodka. And what we and he claimed, and this claim never made sense, right? He claimed, oh, I had a meeting with Szczesny. I had a phone conversation with Szczesny late last year. And he said, oh, I bribed Joe Biden $5 million and it'll take 10 years for them to find it. That's the TLDR, is he said in late 2019 during impeachment, Szczesny had, during impeachment, during the time when Szczesny's investigation was shut down, that according to Chuck Grassley, he said that he had bribed Joe Biden. Didn't make sense. None of it made sense.
Right.
Separati continued his investigation, basically shut down the investigation in August 2020, gave his recommendations to the what's called the PADAG, Richard Donahue, who then reported to Jeffrey Rosen, who pointed to Bill Barr. And that was sort of done. There's these recommendations to Donahue. And then after the laptop is disclosed in October 14th, 2020, Donald Trump calls Bill Barr, is screaming at him because he hasn't come up with a Hunter Biden indictment yet. And days after that, okay, Richard Donahue goes to David Weiss, who already has this open investigation into Hunter Biden, and says, here, you need to check into this informant report about Joe Biden being bribed. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's what we knew before today.
Okay.
Is that, and we also knew before today, or you did, because I've been covering this and I'm the only one who has been,
yes,
that Abby Lowell since November has been trying to get details of this. He's like, look, you know, Bill Barr is involved. Richard Donahue is involved. Rudy Giuliani is involved. Scott Brady is involved. So, you know, starting in November, he's asking for this stuff. What we learned yesterday is that Smirnoff was interviewed by the same team that has been investigating Hunter Biden, was interviewed by him in September, and they're immediately like, he's lying. Okay.
But then this, starting in August, talking about David Weiss, right? He is the special prosecutor on this, and he knew immediately that Smirnoff was lying?
Yeah. And the how is incredibly important, because when Scott Brady has testified, and when that FD-1023 was released by Chuck Grassley last summer, both the FD-1023 itself and Scott Brady have said, oh, well, we couldn't match what Szczesny was saying publicly with what showed up in this informant report. Instead, we checked travel records, and the travel records all lined up. So therefore, we found it sufficiently reliable to pass on. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
What David Weiss discovered starting in August and September of last year, before Abby Lowell started asking for this stuff, what David Weiss discovered is that, no, the travel records don't at all match. Like, in the indictment, so he indicted this dude yesterday, and he indicted him for a false statement and for basically fabricating something, evidence to the FBI. And as part of his indictment, the proof of his indictment is that the travel records don't match up.
Mm-hmm.
So the actual FD-1023, oh, the travel records match up. Scott Brady, in testimony that still hasn't been publicly released to HJC, oh, the travel records matched up. Although, curiously, his attorney in that hearing was a different Bill Barr U.S. attorney, and the U.S. attorney was like, don't give specifics about the travel. So it's clear that they know that probably the travel didn't end up. So now this dude's been indicted. Right. Mm-hmm. And everyone is like in a tizzy, because they're like, oh, my gosh, you know, another one of James Comer's best witnesses has been indicted. Because remember, it's not the first one.
Right.
There's Gal Luft. Tony Bobulinski testified Tuesday and was sufficiently discredited that we haven't heard much about that either.
Mm-hmm.
Tony Bobulinski, his story doesn't match any of nine witnesses, doesn't match the records. Abby Lowell has asked DOJ to consider indicting Tony Bobulinski for lying to the FBI as well. So before we're done, we may get to the point where three informants against Hunter Biden are indicted for lying to the government. But so this is very exciting, because now the press is finally covering problems with this investigation that I've been screaming at them
to cover.
But
are they? Right.
But they're missing the important part.
Yeah.
Right. So in the indictment, David Weiss hides the role of Bill Barr in two different places and hides Rudy Giuliani's role. Mm-hmm. And so this is an indictment against the fall guy, right? Without a further investigation of David Weiss's own role. And this is the point. Like, David Weiss is conflicted. He cannot, you know, the idea, I think, when he was asked to investigate this was, oh, can you check this again and make sure you didn't miss any leads in 2020? As soon as it became clear, as if he didn't know, as soon as it became clear that this guy lied, this needed to be referred to somebody else. David Weiss can't prosecute this guy. He's a witness.
Right.
And he's a witness because Scott Brady, in his testimony, said, I spoke to David Weiss about this project every 6 weeks. I got interrogatories from David Weiss about this project. David Weiss, when his people were reluctant to work with me, David Weiss used some colorful language and made sure that they did this. David Weiss forced his people to take this briefing about the FD 1023, which we now know is a lie. So there is abundant testimony from Scott Brady that David Weiss was personally involved in this effort to frame the Bidens.
Wow.
Maybe he insulated his investigation from it, but there is abundant evidence that Scott Brady knows that David Weiss knows Scott Brady's role, that David Weiss knows Bill Barr's role, that he knows Richard Donahue's role. He should not be prosecuting this.
No.
It needs to be somebody else. And his conduct needs to be at issue because he was in on the frame job. He was in on this effort to frame Joe Biden and his son in 2020. That's what the story should be. And I think by indicting the time of the indictment, you know, so he was out of the country. They arrested him yesterday, the informant, when he arrived back.
Wow.
When he arrived back in the country in Las Vegas. And so maybe the indictment's been sitting there on ice, but I find the timing of the indictment incredibly suspect because in Delaware, which is where the gun crimes are, Hunter Biden is about to file a reply motion for discovery and to start saying there are Brady violations going on. The judge in California said back in January, I'm going to not give discovery on deliberations between prosecutors, but if it's other people who were pressuring this, yeah, I'm going to give discovery on that. So just before these two judges are going to look at whether or not Hunter Biden should get discovery, all of a sudden there's a criminal case against somebody else that is stuff Hunter Biden has been asking for since November.
Wow.
And it, mm-hmm. you know, like I, given some other dickish stuff that they have done, these prosecutors, I would be unsurprised if they try and say, you can't have this discovery now because it would violate the due process of this other.
But the, you posted a photograph. I'm going to put it up on the screen here for those watching.
Oh, this is
video.
a different issue. This is a different issue,
but it's the same. It's David Weiss, who's prosecuting yes. Hunter Biden, alleging that this picture, which you could see is a table saw, it's obviously sawdust, but somebody laid out three lines like they were playing with it like it was cocaine. But he's saying this is cocaine. And someone I'm someone who's done a lot of cocaine in my early years. That ain't it. It's white. This is not. That's not coke. But David Weiss alleged that was Keith Ablow's.
Yeah, we're back to Keith Ablow.
Oh my
right?
God,
Keith Ablow. Literally Keith Ablow.
Keith Ablow me. Yeah. So
okay. So according to Garrett Ziegler, right? So he's this douchebag. That has put all of the contents of the laptop online.
Uh-huh.
According to him, and that's how I discovered this, he's like, oh, this is an error. This isn't, so I owe him this tip, right? Because I don't know cocaine or table saws closely enough to recognize that as an obvious table saw with sawdust on it. But he said, so what happened was in December of 2018, Keith Ablow, sent this picture, which hangs in his office. I've had a source confirm that it resembles the kinds of things that were in Keith Ablow's office
oh
at the
God.
Time. That this is in Keith Ablow's office, and he took a picture of a picture. which explains all the reflections, right? You can see you can see the table there or the shelf or whatever that it's on. Took a picture of a picture, sent it to Hunter Biden and said, this is from a former client of mine. You know, we can talk about the ethical considerations of sending that, but this is from a former client of mine who is a master carpenter and who is trying to beat a coke habit. And he sent me this picture, which he said was his message about beating a coke habit. So that's what the picture is. It doesn't belong to neither did Hunter Biden take the picture, nor is the picture itself Hunter Biden's, nor is it cocaine. And a very experienced drug prosecutor. So one of both of the prosecutors who are prosecuting Hunter Biden in Delaware have solid experience in doing drug crimes. Both of them should recognize cocaine when they look at it. And I was interested in it because as far as I can tell, they have not shared expert reports on the laptop with Abby Lowell. They're trying to basically sandbag Abby Lowell so he doesn't have a chance to make a Fourth Amendment complaint about the laptop. And so that's a technical issue. But as part of that, they have not shared technical reports about the laptop that we know exist, thanks to Gary Shapley. And so I used the picture of the table saw with the sawdust
laid
on
out
it,
like lines
which is
of
not
coke,
cocaine, right? And doesn't belong to Hunter Biden to say one way you would avoid. I mean, so, you know, he might not have read the communications between Keith Abloh because at that point he was still a psychiatrist. He's not now. He's disgraced. But he may not have read the texts that explained the picture. But you should have, if you were doing competent forensics,
right?
You should have looked at the exif on that picture to see who took it, where was it taken, when was it taken, what device was it taken with. Those are the kinds of things you need to introduce as evidence in a trial against Hunter Biden. And so it's not, to my mind, it's not as interesting. I mean, it's hilarious that he used a picture of
ridiculous
and said it belonged to Hunter Biden. It's like, this should be a nonstop scandal that these prosecutors going after the president's son use sawdust to try and implicate him.
Yes.
I mean, look, I'm sure there's a lot of cocaine pictures that belong to Hunter Biden. This ain't one of them.
No.
But he submitted this in a filing to the judge and said, this is Hunter Biden's cocaine, not my ex-client's sawdust. And if he had done his due diligence forensically, right, he wouldn't have made that mistake either.
No.
If he had, like, that, the exif data on that photo, if Keith Abloh was telling the truth, which is a big if because he was involved in a lot of scheming,
sure.
But assuming that Garrett Ziegler is telling the truth and that picture was taken by Keith Abloh, then the poor experienced drug prosecutor doesn't have to recognize that as a table saw and sawdust. He can instead look at the exif data on the photo, or if there's not exif data on the photo, know based on a different forensic report from the laptop that it's not Hunter Biden's, because all of his pictures do have exif data. So he should have been able to look at the exif data and go, that doesn't belong to Hunter Biden. And instead, he represented to the judge that this was Hunter Biden's cocaine rather than Keith Abloh's client's sawdust and table saw.
Wow, wow, wow. This is just, it's a comedy of errors. That would be...
No, it's not. It's a scandal.
Okay.
It's not a comedy of errors. It's a scandal. Had this been a real prosecution, had they been intending a year ago to actually charge Hunter Biden with the gun crimes that they have since charged him with, they would have done a serious analysis of these pictures and they wouldn't have made a mistake like this. And this is the underlying thing. The Hunter Biden prosecutors are now arguing, we always intended to charge him with gun crimes. That's obviously bullshit. And one of the reasons you know it's bullshit is because they didn't get a warrant to access this data until December. And they obviously haven't done a lot of close analysis. Otherwise, they wouldn't think this picture belonged to Hunter Biden and depicted.
Right. Oh,
so my goodness. So this is what's going on, is that they're trying to sustain an investigation because the evidence that he was doing drugs is so good, when the legal question before the judge right now, you know, we may get to the question of how good the evidence, you know, whether this picture of sawdust can be admitted in a trial about cocaine. But the question right now is, did they renege on this plea deal that they agreed to in June? And the answer is, and what, now we go full circle. Now we get back to Smirnoff. Okay. Mm-hmm. The answer is Bill Barr on June 7th, 2020, claimed to Margot Cleveland at the Federalist. She's one of my favorite faceplant. Like, she's ridiculous. But anyway, he went to her and he said, this is when this informant report was breaking. And Jamie Raskin went into a briefing earlier in June with the FBI and said, you know, the FBI told me that Bill Barr shut down this investigation. They didn't find anything with this informant report. Mm-hmm. And then Bill Barr went to the Federalist and said, that's not true. You know, I'm telling you, Jamie Raskin's wrong. That claim, what Bill Barr said in June of last year, like June 7th of 2023, Bill Barr goes public and he says, Jamie Raskin is lying. We didn't close this investigation into Hunter Biden. I gave it to David Weiss to investigate. And we know he gave it to David Weiss to investigate because Donald Trump was screaming at him to indict Hunter Biden. Again, right. That happens in October 2020. So Bill Barr comes out, makes that claim, which, by the way, that claim is now debunked by the indictment yesterday.
Yes.
But David Weiss doesn't tell us that, you know, he's now proven that Bill Barr was lying when he was trying to pressure David Weiss to reopen the investigation into Hunter Biden. So what we know is on that same day, June 7th, same day that Bill Barr is lying about this 1023, David Weiss has agreed to a plea deal with Hunter Biden, which involves no more investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Same day. Right.
Yep.
And then at some point, he decides he's going to investigate whether Joe Biden was really bribed by Burisma. And the investigation gets reopened. And that's what leads to these gun crimes. That's what leads to these felony tax crimes instead of misdemeanors. And that's the story. And that's why, that's the real reason why this informant report matters. But you won't hear about it because they're so all in a tizzy that this guy got arrested.
It's amazing. So the whole David Weiss thing, it's unraveled. Their key informant was just, you know, charged with lying about everything. The whole thing was a lie.
What David Weiss did is, like, I don't know what David Weiss would have done if Abby Lowell didn't start subpoenaing for this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't rule out. I mean, they're doing such crappy stuff. I don't rule out them trying to charge this. Okay.
Wow.
I really don't. But Abby Lowell starts asking for it in November of 2023. It, you know, in the same week that David Weiss testified to Congress and said, this is still an ongoing investigation. You guys are ruining my case against Hunter Biden by asking all these questions.
How dare you?
This is all November.
Right.
So in November, it may well have been the case that they still wanted to pursue, still wanted to treat this informant as credible. But as Abby Lowell, my theory is that Abby Lowell, by demanding this material, forced David Weiss's hand to charge this guy, Smirnoff. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have otherwise done so. He implied in the testimony to HJC that he was going to deal with it in his final report. And instead, now he's had to charge this guy. But again, in charging the guy, I think that David Weiss is trying to insulate Bill Barr, insulate Rudy Giuliani, refuse to provide discovery on this stuff, try and refute the claim that he's selectively prosecuting Hunter Biden. So I think it's tactical. And it's clear that he is covering up the role of Bill Barr. Very clear.
There's a lot of explanation. Obviously, you should go to emptywheel.net and read, but this is from a post that you wrote this morning, February 16th. David Weiss is a direct witness to the crimes on which he indicted Alexander Smirnoff. It's like a soap opera. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up the way it's just unfolding. And you've been, Marcy Wheeler, you've been on top of it all. Before we leave this area and head to Robert Hurd.
Can we talk about the sawdust some more?
Yeah, okay.
I love the sawdust
is classic. That's just this picture.
It's just classic, but it's like, why is this not 24/7 news? Like, why,
I don't know. here, look again. It's this picture is amazing. I looked at that. It's like, okay, it's somebody who obviously, you know, does coke, because he did. You could tell someone was playing with the sawdust and laying it out like lines. But it's the color of wood. It's sawdust. Cocaine is white.
You can see sawdust on the floor.
You can.
Like,
you can see it.
Some of my readers are like, oh, I can tell you that's a DeWalt portable table saw. You know, they're telling me the model year and everything.
That's, oh my God. Yeah, I can't go that far, but I can tell you it is not cocaine. Not cocaine. Okay, now should we talk about this HER report?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So this is the investigation into Joe Biden's keeping some classified documents. Of course, the Trump camp and his sycophants are trying to say, oh, see, what Joe Biden did is exactly what Donald Trump did, which is not. Donald Trump actively participated in stealing classified documents and hiding them when he knew that the FBI or the records department had been trying to get these things back for over a year, and Trump was not cooperating, that they finally got a warrant and went to execute the warrant on Mar-a-Lago, what Trump calls a raid, which was not a raid. And he kept trying to hide them. That's a totally different thing. But they impaneled, a special prosecutor to investigate?
Special counsel, yeah.
Same counsel.
Thing as Jack Smith.
Okay.
They picked, so when the short version of the story is that Robert Hur, deep in the report, found that he didn't have evidence to substantiate that Joe Biden knew he had classified information, and after he discovered he had classified information, didn't give it back. So that's the TLDR, right?
Yep.
What he said in the executive summary, that is what most journalists read, is that when he asked Joe Biden about all this, he was such an old geezer that he couldn't remember anything, and therefore he couldn't, you know, like, he would be a compelling witness on the stand and couldn't be expected to remember stuff that happened in 2017. And in 2017, he was such an old geezer, you couldn't be expected to remember stuff a week earlier. So that's the story that got told, was the old geezer line. The story inside the report is that he didn't have evidence. His chief, like, he really only investigated two things. But let me take a step back.
Okay.
He considered charging Biden for the same crime that Trump was charged with, 18 USC 793E, which is under the Espionage Act. You need to prove three things to charge somebody. One, that they had what's called national defense information, so classified information. Mm-hmm. Two, that they had it willingly, wittingly, intentionally, right? And three, that they refused to give it back. Okay. So with Trump, it's easy to see, right? So you've got nuclear documents sitting next to the toilet. That's the national defense information.
Yes, he did, right?
Two, wittingly. The way in which you prove wittingly with Trump is that you show that he was curating boxes after the time when the archives asked him to give it back and then refused to give it back.
Right.
There are three specific requests of Trump. The archives say, give it back. Archives say give it back again. FBI says give it back. You know, there's the keep give it back that never happened with Joe Biden. So on day one, Robert Hur should have said, there's no way I can prove this. There's no way I can prove, because no one ever asked Joe Biden to give this stuff back.
Right.
Right. So he should have just closed up shop then, said, mm-hmm. I can't, you know, there's no way I could charge this. Instead, it looks like June, around the same time that Mark Meadows, the detail of Mark Meadows and his ghostwriters was breaking. In June, they're like, hey, let's go talk to Joe Biden's ghostwriter. Let's see whether Joe Biden was using these classified documents with his ghostwriter. And so they go through all of the ghostwriter conversations that he had with Joe Biden. And some of these were in 2016 when Joe Biden was still vice president. Some of these were in 2017. And so there's a conversation in February 2017, weeks after, by the way, and this is just insane, weeks after Joe Biden had found some classified documents and given them back.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, there is Joe Biden's intent. He found classified documents. He said, you know, bring these back to the Naval Observatory. That's what happened. We had a witness to that. So weeks after that happened, he says to the ghostwriter, you know, I just found some classified stuff in the basement. And this is what her spent the next, so this would have been early July. This is what her spent the next 6 months investigating. Mm-hmm. What was the classified documents? And so he decided that it's the 66 word phrase that he takes out of context and turns into an 8 word utterance, right?
Right.
In the 66 word discussion, Joe Biden specifically mentions a 40 page handwritten memo that he sent Barack Obama in Thanksgiving 2009 to try and convince Barack Obama to not surge in Afghanistan. And Joe Biden actually kept a copy of this memo in his desk drawer because he considered it, you know, like this was something he wrote. He wasn't sure that it had classified records. It's momentous, right? But her says, no, skip what you say in the 66 words. I'm going to take it out of context and insist that that reference to the 40-page memo is instead a reference to these two file folders of Afghanistan documents that you used to write that memo that were found in your garage.
Right. And is that the 8 words, I just found all the classified stuff downstairs?
Yes. Those are the 8 words. Takes out of context, you know. The plain reading is that it's the memo in the desk drawer because that's what is referenced. Another better reading is that it's the stuff he sent back weeks earlier. The stupid reading is that it's the two file folders that are in the garage inside a tattered box. But nevertheless, her goes through this elaborate effort to try and prove that the file folders in the box are the same file folders, you know, are the ones that he was discussing, even though there's like not a shred of evidence. There's this line in the report where he's like, you know, well-meaning jurors might not be willing to read into these things. And it's like, hey, you're a prosecutor. You shouldn't be reading into these things. Why
right.
should we expect jurors not to do? So he basically invented this this story to hang the. I mean, the other thing that he did is really annoying. Joe Biden took home his diaries.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Biden hid his diaries from everybody else because they're his diaries. He took them home and they were discovered when they did a search of his home.
Diaries are excluded from these presidential archive records, aren't they?
Explicitly.
Yeah.
Explicitly.
So her doesn't refer to them as diaries because they're excluded.
Yeah. That is the most important thing. Biden's attorneys are like, they're diaries. You know, you can't charge him for diaries because DOJ didn't charge Reagan for classified information in his diaries. They are diaries.
Yep.
And what her did, which is a sign of his dishonesty. Okay. And I did a post somewhere where I lay out the numbers, but he refers to diaries 103 times in the report. Of those, 4 or 5 are Biden associates referring to Biden treating these notebooks as diaries.
Uh-huh.
80 some are referring to the notebooks that Ronald Reagan took home, which he treats as diaries.
Right.
But he never, her, in his own voice, calls Biden's diaries diaries, even though the people around Biden call Biden's diaries diaries. Instead, he calls them notebooks like 350 times. And so it is a clear sign of dishonesty in that he's treating Reagan's diaries as diaries, but refuses to treat Joe Biden's diaries as diaries. And eventually he says, I can't charge them because, you know, there's this Reagan precedent. And, you know, maybe Joe Biden thought these were diaries, but it's clear Biden brought them home as diaries. He knew he had them. He didn't hide that he had them. And in the name of this investigation that should have been shut down on day 3, Robert Hur read all of Biden's diaries, found that there was no correlation between the diaries and stuff that ended up in his book. His excuse for why Biden kept these two Afghanistan folders in a tatty box in his. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's not quite as ridiculous as the sawdust, but it's pretty ridiculous. And then he's like, well, Joe Biden kept these two file folders for vindication. I'm like, he doesn't need them for vindication. No. He's got the 40-page memo. Like, what better vindication would you have than a private warning that you send to the president saying, don't do this, you're going to regret this? And by the way, did the entire world regret it? Yes. Joe Biden was right. He has his vindication. Robert Herr invents this, you know, says, well, he must have kept these folders for vindication. That is a stupid motive theory. And yet you're so desperate. I mean, like the middle parts of the report that no one else read, they read like a novel. They really do. I mean, there's like two paragraphs at the beginning of each of them saying, well, Biden thought he was a historic person, the youngest senator. You know, it's just right. Like, it's so pompous. And like, the, well, you know, these two paragraphs at the beginning don't cite anything. They're just like, or if they cite something, they're like, I'm going to cite Obama's memoir. I'm going to cite Robert Gates's memoir. I'm going to cite, you know, it's just shoddy stuff. And you know, because the focus has been on his old geezer can't remember anything shoddiness, there hasn't been enough focus to the middle shoddiness, that he got the analysis of the law wrong, and that his motive theory is stupid, and that he treated Biden differently than he treated Ronald Reagan. And, you know, it's just nutty stuff.
It is crazy. And the takeaway, at least for someone who tuned out the news last week, but of course I got little inklings of this Herr report, and I haven't read it, to be honest with you. I was hanging with my kid last week. It was great. This was a hit job on Joe Biden, where Herr, you know, it could have been like a couple of page report, but it's 388 pages of what amounts to a political hit job. It's saying he's an old doddering fool, and I can't put him on the stand. I can't charge him because he'll come across as a sympathetic doddering old man who doesn't remember anything. It sounds like it was just a hit job.
Yeah, and what you should know, you know, I get accused a lot of being a Merrick Garland defender, and it's kind of crazy because there is not a human being on the face of this earth who has written more about the corruption of John Durham and Robert Herr and David Weiss, right? No one. And so my understanding of Merrick Garland is that he has a naive faith in career DOJ personnel. And you can explain many, many things about Merrick Garland that infuriate people. The other thing you can explain about him is he's got a lot going on that, you know, that people aren't giving him credit for. But when he hired Robert Herr, he treated Robert Herr as a career prosecutor. And that's how he introduced him. You can go back and look at the video. That's how he introduced him. He did not treat Robert Herr, and I'm going to write this up if I ever stop writing about sawdust and, you know, David Weiss being a witness in the investigation that he's part of.
Right.
But Robert Herr was a key player in Donald Trump's DOJ. Robert Herr was Rod Rosenstein's top deputy from 2017 to 2018. Ouch. And then Trump made him a U.S. attorney. We also learned there's a Washington Post report that describes that another one of the people on this investigative team was an Iowa U.S. attorney from Trump. So we had two Trump U.S. attorneys doing this investigation, reading through all of Biden's diaries or notebooks, if you Robert Herr.
Right.
We know, for example, Allison Gill, and I forget which podcast this is in, she does a podcast with Andy McCabe, and they're in last week's podcast, at the end of it, the last 10 minutes, they describe how Robert Herr was involved in firing Andy McCabe.
Oh my God.
Minutes before he retired.
Right. Where
so that they could try benefits. And seize his, they did seize his pension.
Yep.
And then Andy McCabe had to sue and spend a year and a half getting it back. And he won. He won his pension back. So Robert Herr was involved in that. The other thing that I keep coming back to is Robert Herr oversaw the Mueller investigation for a period. And so one of the sleazy things that Robert Herr did in the Biden report is that he's like, oh, the first thing that Biden's attorneys did when they got to the house in Wilmington was search the garage. And he kind of speculates. He just makes this up. He's like, there must have been an attorney-client conversation where Biden told them that there were classified documents in the garage. He makes it up, just makes it up.
Wow.
And he's like, but I couldn't ask because it's attorney-client privilege. Now, I find that really, really interesting, because one of the things that I think was a mistake in the Mueller report, but that he did under the direction of Herr, and I mean, Herr was there for half of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was as soon as you got to an attorney, he stopped the analysis. So, for example, Michael Cohen has said that Jay Sekulow, who was one of Trump's attorneys, has said that Jay Sekulow helped him write his perjurious statement about Trump Tower Moscow wow. in 2017. And he's testified about that openly. If you had done what Heard did and even just speculated about the role of the attorney, then you connect back that false statement about Trump Tower Moscow to Trump, to his attorney. But under Robert Herr, Mueller didn't do that. Under Robert Herr, he did that with Joe Biden. So there are a number of things where Mueller adhered to a much higher standard. I mean, the other thing is, like, the entire Mueller report was 400 pages. This is 388.
Right.
It should have been a 75-page report. Instead, it's a 388-page report with every single document. You know, it's just
over
it's
the
really,
top.
You know, like one of the, like, he spends maybe 12 pages talking about how a handful of classified documents got into University of Delaware. And first of all, like, those would be speech and debate protected mm-hmm. because they're, you know, Biden sent them to Delaware as a senator. And sent them, like, he wasn't retaining the documents.
Right.
Like, the entire point is, like, if you send them to Delaware, you're not retaining the University of Delaware. You're not retaining them. So he spends, you know, maybe 12 pages talking about these documents. Not only do they have no place, but that's a speech and debate protected thing. There's another like the most classified documents they found, the ones at Penn Center, actually were documents, and it's actually sort of nice detective work. It's my favorite part. It's the only good part of the report. Is they're like, where did these documents come from? And they trace them back to this briefing that Joe Biden did in 2015 to try and get senators to support Obama's Iran deal. And you know, he's got a picture of them in the Naval Observatory, and so that's why the documents were there. That's how they were forgotten, and then they got moved from there to Penn Center. So it's actually a really sort of interesting story. Those are the most classified documents that were involved, but it, you know, they were about senators.
Right.
They got the picture like Corker is there. They've got, you know, I think Menendez. You see him facing away from the camera.
He didn't age well.
And interestingly, Herr said of the box, those were found in Penn Center. Well, there's a bunch of stuff in there. So obviously it was not intentionally curated. He said of the box found in Joe Biden's garage with these Afghanistan documents that he spent 388 pages talking about, he's like, oh, he neglected to mention there was stuff that had obviously been just thrown in the box. So, you know, it was a novel. It was,
I need to go back to Merrick Garland and what he could have done here, because apparently there was some back channel communication between the White House and Merrick Garland's office. Again, he heads up the DOJ, and these investigations fall under the DOJ. Merrick Garland saw this report, this 388-page political hit job, as it's been described, before it was released. And I guess the White House at least got wind of what was in it and said, there's personal attacks on the president that have nothing to do with this. And Merrick Garland had a hands-off. He could have said, go back and take out all this bullshit that doesn't belong there, but he didn't.
And this is something, you know, again, back to his naive belief in career prosecutors. There's a guy named Brad Weinsheimer. I'm sure I mispronounced that, and I apologize to him for doing that. And he, there's a rule in DOJ which is always about DOJ protecting itself. It's an ethical role. It's in the department. It's in the deputy. It's in Lisa Monaco's office, but it's a career position. And Garland let him make the decision. And he said, no, it's distinct from what Comey did. It's within the guides of DOJ guidelines. I think that that's wrong. By the way, this guy was appointed to the position by Jeff Sessions.
Oh, God.
So he is the same guy. Brad Weinsheimer is also the guy over. I mean, literally, David Weiss, this is insane. But David Weiss, according to his testimony in November to the HJC, has never spoken to Lisa Monaco ever. The only time he's spoken to Merrick Garland was when in writing he asked to be made special counsel.
Oh my
so
God.
He has, like, there's a rule that you have to have some kind of political oversight of the special counsels. And Garland, instead of doing that, has appointed this guy, Brad Weinsheimer. And, you know, some of the stuff Durham did was you know, egregious was Durham also fabricated stuff. And I, you know, I don't use that word lightly, but he fabricated stuff, right? I think Herr fabricated less, except for that attorney-client privilege conversation that never happened. But his, you know, his application of diaries with Reagan and notebooks with Joe Biden is clear bias. And the doddering old man thing is just ridiculous. And now with David Weiss, it's like, I don't see how you allow him to take this indictment when the investigation, as soon as it becomes clear that this dude lied, the investigation is about Bill Barr. The investigation is about Rudy Giuliani. The investigation is about how DOJ framed Joe Biden in 2020. And you, David Weiss, are a witness. You cannot be the prosecutor because you are a witness, because you were part of that effort. I don't think a witting one, but you are part of the effort to frame Joe Biden in 2020, to use DOJ to frame Joe Biden in 2020. And instead, they've like made this guy, the fall guy, Smirnoff, the fall guy, I think in part as a way to sustain the case against Hunter Biden so that we can have two trials before the election.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So all that's going on, Marcy Wheeler. Now, while we've been speaking, President Biden just spoke at the White House. He said Putin is responsible for the death of Alexei Navalny. So that's ongoing. We are also waiting, apparently, allegedly today, for Judge Engoron's decision in the New York City fraud trial case, where he's seeking they are seeking $370 million in damages, a lifetime ban for Donald from New York real estate,
and
5-year ban for the sons. Is what I read this morning. Anyway, so we're expecting that any time now. It could happen any time today. Or do we know what's happening today?
As far as I know, it's happening today. So that'll be there by the end of the day.
Okay.
We also have a date for Donald Trump's first criminal trial,
which is March 25th.
That is, we're not going to call it hush payments anymore. We're going to call it fraud, because it's another fraud case. It's really his like third fraud case.
So that happened yesterday.
Remember, what he did is, after he paid hush payments so to get elected in 2016, he engaged in financial fraud. Trump Organization engaged in financial fraud to cover up the fact that he had made these hush payments and tax fraud. So that is the crime. And so that is going to go to trial next month. And Todd Blanche's lawyer was squealing about how unfair it was that he should be held accountable for stuff that he did in 2016, 2017, 2018. But there you are. We're finally moving forward to this stuff, and we're waiting.
The Supreme Court.
The immunity. Yeah. This week we saw the immunity filings from both sides before the Supreme Court on Trump's DC trial.
Right.
And they have a conference today, so you may see some response soon. You know, I on this point, I'm an optimist, because I think Supreme Court will do, because first of all, if you listen to the 14th Amendment hearing last week, even Sam Alito was like, you got to have a prosecution before you can DQ somebody from the ballot. And having said that, I think Alito has to say, well, you know, then we have to agree that there can be a prosecution. And if there can be a prosecution for trying to steal the election, then let's have it. Let's get on with it. I'm optimistic. I think that there's a non-zero chance the Supreme Court is going to say, we think DC Circuit has said everything that needs to be said. Let's go to trial. So, you know, when the judge in, the fraud case, that we'll call it Stormy Daniels fraud, was saying, you know, you don't have a trial scheduled in either case right now. So you can't say that you can't have this up to 2-month trial. You know, starting next month, Donald Trump is going to be off the campaign trail.
And
spending all of Republican money on attorney fees to stay out of.
And for that case, he's got to be in the courtroom, because it's a criminal trial. He's got to be there. So
there is a non-zero chance that Donald Trump could spend much of the next 6 months in trial. And for all of those, he's going to have to be in the courtroom.
That's right.
And so, you know, Republicans are signing up for this guy because they don't care that he's a alleged crook, right? But he's going to be, he can't be on the trail. He's going to have to be in New York and DC and maybe, who knows, Florida, standing trial.
Yeah. And there's the other stuff is proceeding too. So we're waiting. We do have the March 25th court date for the New York fraud trial stemming from the Stormy Daniels payoff. While we're waiting for, the ruling on immunity for that trial to go forward and everything else to unfold. But it's looking like it's going to be a very busy next 9 months leading up to the election. Marcy Wheeler, find her at emptywheel.net. Should be one of your first stops every morning in your reading. And if you have funds to donate to support independent, amazing journalism that you're not getting from the corporate media, spend some of it at emptywheel.net. And you can put
some at Nicole Sandler.
At NicoleSandler.com. Marcy, as always, thank you. And we'll talk next week, if not before.
All right. Take care.
No more news that I'm aware of. So with that, we are done. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll have Marcy Wheeler back on next Friday to pick up where we left off. Jonathan Larson with the fucking news will be here on Monday. So we'll get his take on everything that happened as well. All right. Thanks for listening. Peace out.